right. My name's Mike Hyatt. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mike!
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Sober since September 18th, 1996. I want to thank Aaron for asking me to speak. I want to thank John for the lengthy introduction. And, wow, so I'm not a big fan of speaking. I've never considered it my my strong point. And I'm usually funny for about the first 30 seconds, and then it's all downhill from there. So if you I don't know what's that. If you get a chance to take a nap tonight, yeah, that's it. It's over. So we'll start with I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober for 8 years. I'm an active member of the Northern Plains Group, or at least I'd like to believe that. My sponsor tells me that sometimes I should be doing more. I have found many fast friendships here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have many friendships here in the Northern Plains Group. People that I have come to know and love like brothers. And it always makes me somewhat nervous and a little apprehensive when I get a chance to speak in front of people I know, much greater than when I just speak in front of any other person. But I think it's because, you know, I think deep down inside they know who I really am, you know, and it's like you just can't pass BS from up here. So I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about my childhood, which doesn't have a whole lot to do with my alcoholism. As some people come up here and share that they were beaten and that they grew up in a trailer park and their parents were terrible alcoholics, and that unfortunately, is not my case. My parents were good, hardworking farm folk. That's it. My dad's full-blooded Irish. My mom is she's Heinz 57, and they took good care of me. They gave me clothes on my back, fed me, bought me a Commodore Vic 20. Yeah. Yeah, I heard the nerds in the room respond. So they took good care of me. Me and my little brother, we grew up on a farm. We spent my first 9 years there. And, you know, when you're growing up on a farm, you don't have a lot of interaction with the town kids, with exception to school and maybe church. So I didn't really get a lot of interaction with other kids. My brother was kind of like my best friend. And, you know, I was a mama's boy. I wasn't a tough kid growing up. I was never tough until age nine. Well, I wasn't even tough then, let's be truthful. So, however, I didn't have an opportunity to really interact with other kids, and I never had any large classrooms. My school was a conglomerate of schools or of districts put together in one school. So my classroom, I think the greatest classroom I had or the largest classroom I had was in third grade, and there was like 15 kids, and that was big. I mean, my first grade class was, geez, it was like a handful of us off in a corner of the building. So I didn't really learn how to interact with other kids, and I don't know that that's why I'm alcoholic. I can't really put any of that to the acid test, but I know that from my earliest recollection, I felt uncomfortable around other people. I was always accustomed to sizing them up and gauging that against how I felt on the inside. I would look at other people and I'd look at Bobby. Bobby was this kid in Ackley, Iowa, metropolis. Yeah, 1,000 people. Bobby was in like Taekwondo or some other martial art. I doubt it was really Taekwondo. He probably lied about it, but I thought, man, that Bobby's tough, you know, and he looks tough, and I was intimidated by Bobby. I never saw Bobby fight. I don't think he could fight. Now that I think about it, now there was nothing to make me believe he could fight. But I was intimidated by Bobby because he was in Taekwondo, and there was this girl. Her name was Michelle, not my wife, but her name was Michelle, and I thought she was just the most adorable thing. But I couldn't talk to her. I couldn't speak to other people. I couldn't communicate what was on my mind, and I was absolutely terrified that if I let loose and I talked about what was in my head, people wouldn't like me. And I don't think that that's, you know, the level of intellect I had back then wasn't, I didn't consciously think, God, I wish I could talk openly with these other people. I just know that I felt really wormy and I felt really uncomfortable and I was very shy and my mouth got really, you know, you just get really swelled up when you can't talk to people and you look down at your shoes and your hands sweat and you know, you can feel that icky feeling in your stomach. And I never found a solution for that. I'd never found a solution to that. I at age 11, we had moved back to Minot, and there was a night and day difference between Ackley, Iowa, and Minot, North Dakota. Now, Minot's not a big city. However, the town's considerably larger than 1,000 people, and the kids there do things different than kids do in Ackley, Iowa. I mean, we had pinball, and we had a pole position, and you get to Minot, and we start talking about ColecoVision all these other cool game systems and things that I really didn't have any experience with, and I didn't know what they were talking about. And it just aided to the fact of me feeling apart from and separate from and different than. And it was a very awkward time in fourth grade. They thought I was mental or something. I don't know what the deal was. They thought I had some problems, so they went and did some tests on me, and they come back and they're like, oh, well, his problem isn't that he's mental. His problem is that he's very intelligent. And they fed me this line of crap long enough for me to start believing that, man, I have got it. I am on top of the mountain. And so you got this kid that's already got this terrible low self-worth problem, and then you inject this ego on top of him. And, God, I was so screwed up. You know, fifth grade, this kid named Adrian Wilson, he said something to my little brother in the playground, and I was angry, I guess. And I went back into the classroom, and Adrian was sitting in the back of the room. And I remember I was going to beat him up or something. The kid would have whooped me. But I was going to beat him up, so I walked to the back of the classroom, went right by him, grabbed the baseball bat out of there, walked back past Adrian, and went after the teacher. No sense. I don't even know. I have a real problem with focusing my anger, apparently, too. So that, you know, they didn't expel people at that time in fourth grade, but they did make me do some counseling and stuff in order for me to return back to school. And things got worse by the time I was in sixth grade. Me and my brother have always fought. We're just, you know, we're not the kind of brothers that are chummy. We're the kind of brothers that, you know, punch each other in the teeth. And me and my brother got in a lot of fights. And this one time I got in a fight. And when I get in a fight, sanity leaves me. I am like, I see red, the light switch goes off, and things get broken and people get hurt. You know, it's insane. I look like a psycho. So I went psycho on my brother, and I grabbed these butcher knives, and I'm swinging them around at him, and he had already hidden in my mom's bedroom for a while, and I was waiting for him, and he called my aunt. She comes over, comes in the door just after I chuck this knife at him, pins me to the ground. You know, I'm, like, not even conscious. I'm spitting at her, and I got it. I'm a freaking nightmare. And so they sent me to the Jamestown Psychiatric Hospital, and this was my first trip to the psych ward, and I was 11 years old. I went through treatment, and I learned that if you tell them what they want to hear, they'll let you out. So that's what I did. I played the part of the sane kid and the inquisitive and the intelligent and the kind and the, you know, I just played the part. You know, I'm apparently a really good actor. And they let me out of the psych ward. When I returned back to school, you know, in sixth grade, kids, the rumor mill goes and, you know, everyone's talking. And I came back, and they're like, oh, man, so are you crazy? I'm like, yeah, I'm crazy. And I fed into it, and what ended up happening is they ended up giving me the nickname Mike the Psych. Now, yeah, it's not even really cool. I mean, honestly, Mike the Psych, how lame is that? That's sixth grade intellect. I mean, I could have come up with a lot better nowadays if someone went to the psych ward. But Mike the Psych stuck with me. I mean, I'm still getting called Mike the Psych in eighth grade at a different school. So I went to my first psych ward in eighth grade. I got kicked out in sixth grade. Seventh grade, I got kicked out of school. I had to go home by the end of the year. They let me come back in eighth grade. Eighth grade was even worse. I was suspended constantly. I just looked for fights. I looked for reasons to be mad at other people. I looked for reasons to let out this aggression. And I hated myself. My God, did I hate myself. I would look at mind you, because I'm so buff right now, you probably wouldn't guess, but I was a really fat, chubby kid. And so I'm this redheaded, overweight, I got braces, and I looked homely. So I'm this really homely kid, and I was just begging for people to pick on me. I got a third tire, maybe a fourth or fifth, and so people picked on me all the time, and I would get into fights all the time. And anyway, I got kicked out of eighth grade again, and that's when I started my round of psychiatric hospitals. I went to three more psych wards, and then I ended up in Dakota Boys Ranch. Long story short, I spent some time away from home, a good year and a half in the Boys Ranch, and another half a year to a year throughout the different psych wards and waiting facilities. And I tell you what, I was in Dakota Boys Ranch, and there may be some kids here that are in the DBR. I was in the Dakota Boys Ranch up near Minot, and when I went to the Boys Ranch, I actually liked it, you know, because for the first time, I was around kids that were just as screwed up as me, and I fit in, you know. It was cool if you got in a fight, you know. It was cool if you had war stories. I found other people that were very similar to myself, all of us lacking a solution, but very similar to myself. And so I'm in Dakota Boys Ranch now. Mind you, I'm 16 years old, and at age 16, this is 1991, I had the opportunity to go to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. And the first meeting I went to was at the clubhouse in Minot. It's the 515. And I went in this clubhouse, and my aunt's an alcoholic. She'd been sober. I don't know. She got drunk once or something, and it got really bad. And then she just – I guess the Big Book talks a lot about women just going downhill quickly. And within a year, she was just on the bottom. And she got sober, and she was at the clubhouse there. And it was my first experience in the clubhouse, and I remember that there was a lot of old people. You know, I'm 16, so everyone looked old. I would have looked old. But there's a lot of old people there, and they're smoking cigarettes, and everyone's talking about the things they lost and the troubles that they had. And the clubhouse, I think at the time, didn't seem very healthy, from what I remember now, it didn't seem very healthy there. And I guess what I got out of Alcoholics Anonymous at the time was that if you go to AA meetings, you can smoke. So I went to AA meetings to smoke. I didn't care what anyone had to say. I'd only had a few drinking opportunities to drink at this time, so my drunk-a-log was like the same three stories over and over again. You know, I'm sure these people were just like, "Could the kid shut the hell up?" But I had this weak drunk-a-log, and I ended up getting discharged or removed from the Dakota Boys Ranch, and my life turned upside down. When I got out of Dakota Boys Ranch, because I had some structure in my life, I had the opportunity to take my grades from failing, which they'd failed all the way from like fifth grade on. In fact, I think the only reason they got me through school is because they could not handle me. So they just escalated me to the next grade with hopes that I would eventually be out of the system. I had some structure, and my life was going rather well. I had B's and A's from going to – I had half days at the Dakota Boys Ranch School and half days in town. I had B's and A's. I was talking appropriately with other people. I was behaving well around my mom and dad. I wasn't punching holes in the wall. I was actually acting like a pretty good kid. Not the perfect model citizen, but, you know, as well as you can be for someone as nuts as I was. And everything fell apart. God, I met up with a couple of kids that were just as screwed up as I was in Dakota Boys Ranch, and I started drinking. I had my first opportunity to drink. I can tell you this funny story. This girl, her name's Charity. I can't remember the last name because I didn't really care anything about her name, but she was really sexy, and I was really lonely, and I lusted after her as effectively as I could, and there was that whole unrequited love poem thing and the whole feeling sorry for my – it's a pretty sad story. Feeling sorry for myself, but she felt sorry for me too, which was really cool because I dig it when chicks feel sorry for me. So this is how lame I am. So I ask her what she's doing, and she says, "Well, I'm going out with my boyfriend." I'm like, "Cool, can I come along?" Her boyfriend's like this, you know, 22, 23-year-old guy what we call Minot Wingnuts. He worked on the Air Force Base, and, you know, she's like 17 by this time, 18. And so I get a chance to go out, and I walk into the liquor store with him, and I picked up Smirnoff Vodka. Smirnoff was the first hard drunk I think I ever had. And I bought it because it looked cool, you know, glass bottle, big bottle, cool stickers and stuff all over it. It's like, yeah. So we went to this crappy little hotel, Stardust or something like that, on the edge of town, and I managed to get myself liquored up in about 3 minutes. I didn't understand you had to pace yourself. You know, if you lay back on the bed and you drink out of the bottle like this, it doesn't, and you have no tolerance, it does not take long before you can't even move your mouth, you know? So I'm blasted drunk, I'm laughing. All these other people from the Air Force Base showed up, and when I started drinking and before the effect quickly overtook me, I felt very uncomfortable. And by the time it was done, I thought these guys were my best friends. I had new friends, you know. I remember that I couldn't walk, and this girl that I liked had to hold me up while I peed. And it was terrible. There's a lot of other embarrassing things from that night, but it got worse. Needless to say, I woke up with a hangover for my first time. I puked all over my floor, and I remember waking up, and this is probably the last of my drunk story, but I remember waking up and looking on the floor, and there was a heart on the floor. Well, when you're coming out of a hangover, things are really fuzzy, and your head's not working very right. And I thought, oh my God, what did I eat last night? Turns out, I guess I'd eaten some of those red carnival hot dogs, you know? Those bright red ones. So it looked like I had chicken hearts on my floor. But I remember I woke up from that hangover and I went into my brother's room. We still lived in the same house. And I went over to my brother's room and I'm like, Joe, man, I was liquored up last night. He's like, I know. And I'm like, you do? Well, you were in here screaming and blabbing. And I was like, oh, crap, really? Yeah, mom knows. Really? Oh, dude, I mean, just, you know, you sheet whites like I'm busted, you know? So I got grounded. I don't know how long it was. I'd love to tell you it was a month, but it probably wasn't. The liquor I hid outside in the stairwell, apparently she heard me pull up and we were making a bunch of noise and she basically watched me try to stash this bottle drunken. I was a dork. So I got better, I'll tell you that. Anyway, that was my first fun night drinking and I had several more, many more. And then at some point by the age 20, I was... By the age 20, I had I'd found myself I was homeless. I was couch surfing, as we call it now in AA. Only it wasn't because people had compassion for me. It was because I had drugs. So you know, if you score some drugs, Heitling can crash on our couch just as long as he doesn't pee in the corner when he wakes up. So I was couch surfing. I had a motorcycle. I had one of the I had a rare edition. It was a Kawayama Harley. Kawasaki frame, Yamaha front end, and a Harley Davidson tank and tail. Simmons, you remember that bike? Wasn't that sweet? Come on. So I had my Kawayama Harley and a backpack full of clothes and some changes of underwear, lots of changes of underwear, so you guys know. I was morally, you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I showed up in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm gonna get sober here. When I showed up in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had sold everything I could possibly sell. I had cheated everyone I could possibly cheat. I had lied. I was a thief. I had sold and given up on every moral that I'd ever been taught. I was the most indecent human being that I can imagine. I've met guys sicker than me, but there's not a lot. Kelvin remembers when I came in. He thinks I was pretty sick. He was sicker, but I was a waste of space on earth. I really was. I had nothing to offer anyone, and I couldn't understand when I went to treatment. These guys have these great stories. You know, this jag on an airplane, awesome. This guy's going to jail for 55 years, sweet. I woke up in a closet. That's it. I woke up in a closet and I was all messed up and I urinated myself or anything, but I was messed up and I wandered myself down the road and I wasn't sure if I was in Minot or Bismarck or where I was at, and I found this facility that I recognized, and so I knew it was in Minot, and I called my little brother and I said, Joe, come pick me up. When he did, he said, well, dude, that's treatment. So in my delusional state, it appeared to me that, you know, clouds broke and heaven shined down and told me that this was the way to go. It's time to go to treatment. Now, mind you, my intent was not to stop drinking or stop smoking dope. It was the treatment vacation, because those are sweet. Because psych ward vacations are just as sweet too. You don't have to do schoolwork. None of that. So I called my mom and I went down to her house and she said, well, if you go to treatment and you stay sober, I'll pay for it. Sounds sweet to me. I didn't consider the opposite of that, that I'd have to pay for it. But I went to treatment, and I woke up 2 weeks later in the middle of a meeting. I came in, and I had a high blood alcohol level 12 hours after I quit drinking. I mean, I drank every day, so my tolerance had gotten so bad that it actually reversed on me. And after two drinks, I'd start slurring, and I'd black out immediately. And I woke up 2 weeks later in one of those circle groups in the counseling center or in the treatment facility, and I was like, oh, my God. I'm in treatment. I kind of knew I was here, but I'm really here. And I had a weekend pass that weekend because it was the first full weekend I was off of the medication. Apparently they don't send you out when you're all high on Valium. So the first weekend I was out, I went right over to my friend Sean's house and I got stoned. And I came back, and the amount of remorse I felt for what I did and the guilt that I felt and the shame I felt, I thought was enough to keep me sober. And I went back and I pleaded my case and I told him, hey, look, I used. And And they said, well, you know, well, I don't know what we're going to do. And I said, well, you know, there's these guys that came and talked this way. Let me tell you, that weekend before, some guys came to treatment that Saturday night. And they showed up, and this guy named Gerard T. came in. And Gerard T., if anyone knows Gerard, he's not like Mr. Suave. He's not Mr. GQ. He's got these rosy cheeks, really rosy cheeks. And he's, you know, a bigger guy, and he's just goofy. He looked really goofy to me. And I thought, well, this is a nerd if I've ever seen one. You know, I'm really tough at the time. I've got the razor blade sideburns, and I've got the big nasty biker goatee, and I wore a headband, and I swore all the time because that's cool. And Gerard was the last kind of person that I would want to talk to, much less relate to, much less spend any time with. But Gerard got up to the podium, and for the first time in my life, I identified absolutely with what this guy had to say about his feelings. Now, I didn't have the circumstances of Gerard. My dad didn't do this, and I wasn't 19 when I first came to AA, and blah, blah, blah. I didn't relate to those things, but Gerard talked about the feelings, his insecurities, his inadequacies, his inability to communicate with other people, to do the right thing despite the terrible consequences, and he talked about his drinking. Gerard was seasoned enough in Alcoholics Anonymous to know what the disease was about. And he talked about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I related. And I think for the first time, someone in Alcoholics Anonymous gave me hope. And I really believe that, my God, well, this guy's life completely changed. So, you know, I got his phone number, and I started going to some meetings with him and hanging out with him. And the guy drugged me off to coffee, and I'm sure I was just an embarrassment. Gerard looked like the typical college preppy guy, and I looked like a, you know, road-worn biker, and I swore all the time. I was just an embarrassment, I'm sure, but the guy spent more time with me than I see more guys in our group spending time with newcomers. I mean, I was like his sidekick, you know? It's like Tonto to his the Lone Ranger. I don't know what that means, but I was with him all the time, and he got me introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he taught me what Alcoholics Anonymous was about, and he started going through the book with me, and he started teaching me the ropes, what I would call them, the things that we call our basics. You know, shaking hands with new people, shaking hands with everyone, standing in line, thanking the speaker, suiting up, showing up, coming to regular meetings, and it's a hell of a deal. I was presented at that point with evidence. I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous worked for some people. But I think I still had some doubts that it would really work for me, that it would solve these deep emotional, psychological problems that I had. And September 17th, I had been working at this beekeeping place, and there's another story in there I'm not even going to go into, but I was working at this beekeeper's place against my sponsor's advice, and I had managed to get stoned for the last 2 weeks. I couldn't say no. These guys would pull out this one-hitter, and we go in the back, and I get stoned, and I just couldn't say no. I knew I shouldn't be doing it, but I didn't have anything to stop me from doing it. And I was every time I did it, I got worse and worse. I felt more and more remorseful. I was just about out the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we were sitting in the cab of this vehicle on September 18th, it would have been, and I had these guys pulled out the one hitter, and they pulled out the grass, and I thought, here it goes again. You know, I'm going to do this because I can't say no. And I'm going to feel terrible. I'm not going to enjoy this feeling. I'm going to feel absolutely terrible. And I was getting really suicidal at this point, you know. And I remember thinking, well, I put my hands together and, you know, I'm working with construction quality people. These guys, they swore all the time and they drank and smoked constantly. They were rough people. And I remember putting my hands together and just, you know, I looked out the window and I remember I prayed earnestly to God to remove the obsession. And he did. It was the most amazing thing. Now, I'm not telling you that I felt this amazing light glow from within me or anything like that, or this amazing power wash over me. But the obsession to use was gone, and I knew I didn't have to take a hit. And I said no. And that started my new sobriety date. My sobriety date is September 18th. I haven't found it necessary to drink or take any mind-altering substances since then. So I'm at this turning point where it's like, well, God, I'm going to have to start doing something in my program. I've been given the facts. I have evidence. I've seen enough people in Alcoholics Anonymous whose lives have changed. But there's just something that's not working for me. Now, mind you, I'm meeting with newcomers. I've got three guys I sponsor in mine. That's a lot of people because the meetings just are small. I mean, there's like 600 people in here. I was reasonably active for a year of sobriety or 2 years of sobriety, and I knew there was something missing, and I had always been led to believe that there was the side of AA, and then there was the spiritual side. What I came to understand is that there is no spiritual side and no action side or other side. This is a spiritual program. That's where the core of this program is built. It's built upon me struggling through life, working through difficulties, character defects, resentments, fears, to eliminate those things great enough for me to have and establish and maintain a relationship with the God of my understanding. I was one of those guys that got in, sobered up, and turned into an instant saved Christian. I wanted to save the world. I thought that was my solution. I didn't leave Alcoholics Anonymous over, but I very easily could have had I not had a strong sponsor that told me, look, Mike, church is a great thing, and your relationship with God and Christ that's great. That's fine. I'm happy for you. But I know plenty of priests that die drunk. I know plenty of priests that can't keep a day of sobriety. And if you want to stay sober, you will do Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the time, my sponsor's voice was louder than my head, so I said, absolutely. So I managed to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I managed to work through tons of resentments. Calvin, my great nemesis, he's been on every resentment list I've ever had, and in half the conversations I've ever had with a sponsor. And I know I'm not the only one here, so don't you judge me. I've worked through them, I work through them, and then they crop back up. I have fears that I've worked through, and then the fears come back. And that's just part of life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not immune from these things. I didn't walk in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and God didn't come in and reach down and grab every character defect out of me and say, there you go, Mike, you're going to live this amazingly pure life. That's just not the way it worked for me. If it worked for you that way, awesome, and I want to talk to you after the meeting because it sounds pretty interesting, but it's not my story. My story is I still battle with the same character defects over and over. Sometimes they're removed. Sometimes I feel as though they're removed, and then they come right back up, I'm an alcoholic. My problem is alcoholism. My solution is Alcoholics Anonymous. The feeling that I got from alcohol has now been replaced by the relationship with God and the fellowship that I feel in rooms like this with people like you. And I know I don't have to drink anymore. Does that mean that I'm immune from my next drink? Absolutely not. I've heard it said that I'm not 8 years sober, I'm no further away than my next drink than when I was a day sober. And that's very true. I can start taking actions tonight when I leave this meeting that will lead me down the road a week later, because I'm sick. My head spins quick. And if I don't watch myself, I can easily find myself in a position where I have no power over the next drink. The book tells us that. So where am I at today? I've got a pretty damn good life. I really do. I've got a lot of friends here, and there's a lot of people I love, and I try to be as active as I can. I'm not the most active guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not the most perfect role model. I don't have every solution. However, I have a sponsor. I am sponsored, and I sponsor other people. I've got a God that I pray to in the morning and a God that I pray to at the night, and sometimes 15 times through the day, depending on how me and Calvert are doing. But my life is pretty damn good. I got married in Alcoholics Anonymous. The people in my wedding were in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've gotten jobs in Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to be responsible at a job, because I wasn't responsible at jobs before I came here. I couldn't maintain a job. But I learned how to suit up, show up, shake hands, act appropriately, be of service. And these things have propelled my business career. My family life is going pretty good. I've got a wife who's an Al-Anon, and I used to sit in meetings and I'd go to conferences and I would judge the living hell out of Al-Anon. I thought they were the most whiny, cryy people I'd ever met. I had absolutely no concept of what Al-Anon was about. And I was ignorant to it, really. And it's not like I invested any time to try to understand Al-Anon. However, my wife got involved with Al-Anon a couple years ago, and Al-Anon has absolutely changed and transformed our marriage. It has given it's a breath of fresh air, and I will never talk bad about Al-Anon again. As much as I may not understand what I don't really understand much about what they talk about. But it sure as hell works for her. So I'm really grateful for Al-Anon, and I defend it every chance I get. I've got two beautiful children that love me and that want to spend time with me and give me some of the greatest hugs and cry if I don't get a chance to hug them before I leave at night. And man, I just absolutely love my life today. And I'm not saying it's perfect, because it is far from that. In fact, me and Calvin have had... I know I keep coming back to it, but it's been a huge issue in my life. It's true. Calvin won't deny it either. But I've had to do a lot of work, and I think the relationship I've had with people like Calvin and other people that I've had difficult times with have forced me to do things in Alcoholics Anonymous that I did not want to do. I've had to humble myself in front of other people that I never would have wanted to humble myself in front of. I've had to take actions in Alcoholics Anonymous that I am just too lazy to want to take. I've had to do things in Alcoholics Anonymous because it's kind of like I think God removes enough things in me that I'm able to maintain my sobriety and stay reasonably happy. But he has not removed everything. And those things that he does not remove are those exact same things that put me on my knees in the morning and allow me to wish to surrender. And you know what? There's some days I don't want to surrender. There are some days I think, myself is too great for me to surrender today. And those are the days that I have to pray for God to take from me everything that I can't give him. And it's just that simple. And I hope that I continue to grow in AA. I hope I continue to stay sober. I know I'm going to try to do the right thing as often as I can, and I know I'm going to keep looking for the guy that's still suffering. And I know there's some new people out here in the audience tonight, and I've seen some new faces, and I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you that if you're not quite sure if this thing's going to work or if it's even worth it, if you're like me, you probably think it's just a bunch of hokey crap and nonsense, because I did. I really did. I didn't buy into what these guys were in their shirts and ties and their pretty looks. I thought these guys have no concept of what suffering is, because I'm suffering, and that's how I felt. But I stuck around long enough for people to share with me the truth about their alcoholism, the truth about the solution in Alcoholics Anonymous, their relationship with God, and they gave me step two. They handed it right over to me. They said, hey, look, here's your hope you're looking for. And as a result of that, I have not found it necessary to drink since September 18th, and I hope that that remains my sobriety date for the rest of my life. I love all of you in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, I'd love to get to know you. And for those of you that have played such an integral part in my sobriety, thank you so much for everything that you've done. I love each and every one of you, and with that, I'm going to pass. Yeah.